Hello, my name's Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, made in partnership with my friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. And in this episode, my musical guest is iconic. He's a band leader, guitarist, songwriter, producer, and activist. He grew up in Manhattan among musicians, poets, dope smokers, and hellraisers. Thelonious Monk and Lenny Bruce hung out in his front room at home. He produced David Bowie's biggest album, made Madonna a superstar, and put the funk in Duran Duran. He has survived cancer twice and donates so much to so many different charities. His music plays in the soulful cathedral of all of our lives. Please welcome Nile Rodgers. Nile Rodgers, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for the charity Help Musicians. How are you?
I'm really well. Fantastic, actually.
It's really good to see you. When I was a young lad, my bedroom was a sanctuary for me. It was the place where my imagination grew and all of my ambitions were born. What was your bedroom like? Was it full of that?
I had many bedrooms. I had a very nomadic childhood, so I never lived in the same place longer than a few weeks to a few months until I could actually control my own destiny, which was around 14 years old.
Yeah, me too. 14 was the jump-off age. So what was your room like then?
So I was a runaway. And at that point, my girlfriend's mother was open-minded enough to let me live with my girlfriend. How cool was that? So that room was a green room and not much in the way of decor, but because her mom was quite bohemian and hip. You know, I come from a real hip background. Everybody were, you know, into jazz, and, you know, my parents were beatniks, so I grew up as a hippie, and things were very, very cool and open. So I don't know about my decor in that room, but I can think of the spiritual atmosphere was one of artistry, openness. I was quite inquisitive. I wanted to know everything about everything, and I was immersed in music and science. Those were the two things that sort of blew me away.
So when you were asking those questions, who answered them for you?
The world around me. I mean, America in those days was a very different place than it is now. I'm just speaking intellectually. You know, just like UK had the Industrial Revolution, we had the intellectual revolution. It was like all of a sudden in the 50s and 60s, philosophy and alternative lifestyle and things like that became part of the lexicon of the beatnik and hippie culture. So we were always asking questions and getting answers from strangers or collectives that you would hang out with. I happen to be around a lot of musicians who I still to this day, I believe are the most altruistic artists in the world, because musicians can't wait to sit down and show you something that they think is cool. Check this out.
Yeah, right. So around the same time, there was like a musical revolution too, I guess.
Oh, indeed. So I grew up in the Woodstock era. So okay. I was really fortunate, man. In the old days, what we meant by straight people, it didn't necessarily denote their sexual preferences. Mm-hmm. Straight meant corny. You know, like 9 to 5, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm.
People who in gray suits
carried briefcases to work and things like that. And they all ate dinner together and that sort of, that was like straight family life. My family was the antithesis of that. I never had any rules as a child. I can't ever remember my parents ever, and I mean this sincerely, my parents ever telling me what time to come home. Like in America, there was a thing, kids are supposed to come home from playing outdoors when the street lights came on. It was time to come home. Now, in my mom and my dad's head, this was completely ridiculous and superfluous, because what do street lights have to do with living life and amassing knowledge or having fun? They illuminated the streets so you could stay out longer. My parents knew that I came home when there was nothing to do. They didn't worry about me getting into trouble or anything like that, because I was a good kid. I was socialized to care about people. I was overly polite. So my life was wonderful. So straight families would probably think that my upbringing was reckless and, oh my God, how could his parents be like that? And so and so. Funny, I turned out pretty good. Their kids that had lots of supervision and whatever, were always looking for ways to get around the parents' supervision. They were always looking for ways to get around the rules.
Escape.
I never had any rules, and my parents knew that I was savvy enough to make up my own rules. Like, you know, do what you think is fun, you know, and then come home and tell us about it. We had a wonderful hippie / beatnik bohemian life, and it was great. I mean, I learned so much about the world. Now, it wasn't all peaches and cream, because my parents were also heroin addicts. And as they spiraled downward into heavier and heavier addiction, they became less available to me. So I'd have to find out life's answers on my own.
Who did you lean on when they were spaced out?
Fellini. No, I So let me just give you a little bit more of the backstory.
Sure.
I was baptized Roman Catholic. So right. I started out the first 2 years of my school life, my formal school life, in Catholic school. The first Catholic school I went to, they adored me, and I fit in really well. It was in the South Bronx, where it was a mixture of kids, black, white, Puerto Rican, and other. But then my mom had her second child when I was 6 years old, and she was suffering from postpartum depression and threatened to kill my little brother daily. So they separated my brother from my mom, put him with his paternal grandmother, and I was shipped off to Los Angeles to live with my maternal grandmother, my mom's mom, mm-hmm. who had since moved away to L.A. to join my paternal grandmother, if you can keep track of mm-hmm. all that. So I got to L.A., and I was still enrolled in Catholic school. And in L.A., I didn't fit in the Catholic school that I went to at all. I was the oddball out. I was the only black kid in an all-white school. Catholic schools are private schools, so mm-hmm. You have to pay. And even though my grandmother was happy to pay, because she's the one who baptized me and made me mm-hmm. Roman Catholic, I rebelled right away because I was skinny, sickly, and the children made me feel unwelcome. So I did something that, in retrospect, I am so proud of. Chris, I got to tell you, man, you know, if we were on the other side of the house where my studio is, you'd see like Grammys and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Platinum Records and They all are dwarfed by this record that I set at 7 years old. I set the national truancy record. At 7 years old, I cut school for 75 days straight and went to the movies. I saw everything from, you know, in those days in America, we didn't have a rating system. So if mm-hmm. a kid could pay, you can see a movie. It didn't make any difference what it was. So I saw everything from Truffaut to Fellini to, you know, I loved foreign movies. I loved all movies. And in mm-hmm. Los Angeles, we had the grindhouse format, which was, you go in and you pay one admission price and they show five films. So typically it was a first run film with four films of lesser quality, so they would say. But in fact, those films of lesser quality were typically great films. They just happened to be foreign films.
So the cinema was your home in a way.
Yeah,
for
that's,
a while, 75 days.
I learned everything there. So I was only caught cutting school because one day, you know, when you're a kid and you make plans, you really think you think everything through. I never thought my grandmother would get the flu. She got the flu and she was homesick. And I pretended to go to school as normal. And she didn't leave that day. And I was like, oh, I guess she's going in late. But when I came home to carry out the facade and the charade of going to school, she was there lying in bed with a temperature. And the police were there. The truant officers in those days were part of the police department. And I avoided them for 75 days by using such clever schemes as, I was born an asthmatic, so I got a note from a doctor once, and once I got that one note, I was able to forge it and make many notes from the one note, and I would get the local winos and the derelicts around the liquor store, but I would get them to sign it because I was smart enough to know that an adult's handwriting and penmanship looked a little bit more developed than a seven-year-old's penmanship. And plus, my penmanship still looks like a seven-year-old's penmanship. So it's, but I was smart enough to figure that out. So anytime the police would catch me wandering the streets, I would whip out this note and say that I have asthma and I missed the first part of my school day. But, you know, I go to Catholic school, which in a strange way to most police in LA was a sort of, it was like Scientology or something sacred. Like, wow, Catholic school. What's that? Oh, I've heard of those things. So I would say, well, in Catholic school, if you miss half the day, you can't go the rest of the day. And also with asthma, sometimes I might have bronchitis or some other type of infectious disease that, you know, and I don't want to spread it to the other kids and the cops. Okay, okay.
Do you remember seeing any musical films there?
Oh, my God, of course, of course. Tons of them. You name them. You just name one. I guarantee I can sing it.
Well, I mean, there were so many musical films, quite a few of them.
No kidding, hundreds of them, hundreds.
But then there was lots of great musicals too, like West Side Story, Easter Parade. There was a whole raft of great musical films.
Yeah, the whole Busby Berkeley series and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
I know all that stuff. I mean, I know not only the big, gigantic, famous ones, but remember, in the Grindhouse format, you'd see the first runs, which were like West Side Story, but then you'd also see what they would call second run films, which would be movies like Three Sailors and a Girl, that has one of the dance numbers of all time.
Yeah. When you're in Los Angeles, was that where you got your first guitar or your first sort of taste of what music was for you?
That was my first taste of guitar. I had been a musician since I was schooled. So I started out on the flute and the piccolo, and then I switched. Now, this was funny. So I had asthma, right? When I was a kid, I was born an asthmatic. And my first instrument that they assigned to me was the open hole flute. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, really.
So I went from the open hole flute to open hole piccolo. Not as bad. And then some genius teacher gave me a closed hole flute, and it was like, whoa, I'm a virtuoso all of a sudden. And then I switched to the clarinet. Woodwinds were my primary instrument in those days, but because, as I said to you earlier, I had a nomadic existence, and music was part of the standardized American curriculum. So whenever you went to another school and you went to music class, typically they didn't assign you the instrument that you were playing in the school that you had previously attended. The main reason why is because at six and seven, we all sucked. We're not Mozart. So we all stank, so they didn't care what you played. So I would go from tuba to trombone to baritone horn to French horn, which now that's comical. You should hear me play French horn.
I'd love to hear me
on the floor crying. French horn players can't even play French horn, so
they can't. No.
They always get picked on. It's like
it's an animal sound.
Yeah, I remember in the in my old band classes, every day the conductor would come in with some joke to pick on either the French horn players or the bassoon players. I'm in the woodwind section, so he would say, "All right, question for the day: what's the difference between the clarinet and the bassoon?" And we'd all sit there and think, and we'd say, "Well, do you mean the B-flat clarinet or the E-flat clarinet?" "Well, any clarinet, actually." "Do you mean a bass bassoon?" "No, no, just in general. What's the difference?" "The bassoon burns longer." So
that's pretty good.
Man, I wouldn't trade my childhood, even the bad parts, because they weren't that bad, for life the way that I see children being raised now. Because we
Absolutely.
Really were raised in a super intellectual environment. They wanted kids to be smarter. They wanted you. When I started to contemplate infinity, which was really in the first grade because of being in Catholic school, and they would say how you'd burn in hell forever and you go to heaven forever. Forever? Really? Forever? What does that mean? And and I looked up forever, and then I see the definition, and it says infinity, infinite, forever. So I started to question teachers, and I'd get punished because this wasn't based on science. You see, this is based on faith. My brother is not baptized. Why is he going to burn in hell forever? Why can't he just burn there for a little while and then come up and join me? He didn't do anything.
Absolutely.
He just wasn't baptized. Well, I'm sorry, only Catholics can go to heaven. But he can go to purgatory and limbo, and then we can pray for his sins. Well, there aren't any sins. He's a baby. What if he... I mean, is peeing on himself a sin? Well, if that's the case, I'm going to hell because I wet the bed until 6 years.
We all going to hell. But how did you get from wind instruments that were causing you asthmatic problems to a guitar with six strings on it?
What happened was the 60s happened, LSD happened, Timothy Leary happened. I was a R&B jazz music person. Now, of course, I played classical music in school, but at home, we listened to modern jazz, which is another word for bebop. So it was always... That's what I grew up with, you know. I mean, just everything, you know, Monk, and these people Amazing. Were friends of my parents. And you know,
really?
So, yeah, I grew up in the scene because my parents were heroin addicts. And unfortunately, heroin addicts typically become heroin dealers to support their own habits. So it was pretty much common knowledge that most jazz musicians in that era were heroin addicts. And if not most, certainly a massive number of them. So they'd come to my parents' house, and they were our friends. And I knew so many of these people. It was great. So my grandmother died when I was about 15, and I know I just skipped a bit, so let me just fill in this quick blank. Mm-hmm. So I used to be a roller skater, and we used to go to this place. I don't know if you know Los Angeles well, but the roller skating rink was on Sunset Boulevard and Western, and that was quite far from my house because that's in Hollywood, and we lived in what they call South Central LA, which is the hood.
It's a bit of a drive.
Well, yeah, and we didn't drive. We were kids, so we hitchhiked or we took the bus. We preferred to hitchhike. So this day we were hitchhiking to the skating rink, and we couldn't get a ride for a long time. So when we arrived at the skating rink, we arrived in between sessions, which is 3 hours, and we decided, well, we'll wait till this session is over and go to the next session so we could skate the full amount of time. And we just happened to notice that these kids on the other side of the street had really long hair. Now, look who's talking now. I got really long hair. But in those days, most black people, we cut our hairs very close cropped. Mm-hmm. It was a style called the quo vadis. But we saw these guys, and they had really long hair. This was the first time we saw what would soon be called hippies. But in mm-hmm. the beginning, they didn't call themselves hippies. They called themselves freaks. And, Chris, I left out a really important point here. So I was a glue sniffer, and when you sniff glue, you're really jovial. And we were so friendly, and we said, let's go talk to those guys with the hair that's like in their faces like that. So we're like, how could they see walking down the street? They were like, oh, I mean, that's what it looked like to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went over and we talked to these guys, and we said, wow, who are you guys? They were pretty buzzed. They were high already. And they said, oh, wow, man, we're freaks, man. You know, like, we're freaks. And we said, freaks? And, of course, me being the movie aficionado, I said, freaks? You mean, like, we accept them. We accept them. One of us. One of us. Goonie gobble. Goonie gobble. One of us. And they started laughing. They went, wow, Spade Cats, man, into freaks. That's so cool. They said, you guys want to take a trip? And we looked at our watches or whatever. We had a little Mickey Mouse watch. And we were like, well, we still got another 2 hours to burn. Sure, let's take a trip with these guys. We had no idea they meant take what LSD. Yeah. We had never heard of LSD. We didn't know what that was. So they drove us up to this house in the Hollywood Hills, not far from the skating rink at all.
And you were young then, too.
Yeah, 14.
Wow.
Yeah, 14 years old. And we get to this house that appeared, to my memory, to be all glass. We're like, wow, this is amazing. And we went inside this house. And I honestly don't know how we ingested the LSD, because we didn't even know what it was. So it could have been blotter. It could have been they just could have put it on our tongues. They could have put it in a drink or something. I don't even know.
Were you frightened?
No, we didn't know what it was. How could you be frightened?
Sure.
No, these guys were fun. They were friendly. They were cracking up. They were laughing their heads off. These guys are from Mars, but they were nice. And people were having sex everywhere. They were like all over the place. A big swimming pool behind the house. And people were openly having sex. Now imagine, we're like 14, 15. See, if you go and look up the year the Doors first album came out, that's how old I was. So I somehow forget, but maybe I was 16. But still, at 16, our hormones are raging. And they called it bawling. They were bawling. Hey, man, like, you know, like, we're gonna, man, I'm going to go over here with Amber, man, and we're, like, going to go over and bawl near the pool. LSD wasn't a thing that was talked about yet. LSD was still legal. So they weren't even breaking any laws. They weren't doing anything that we could get arrested for. Well, we couldn't get arrested for the LSD, but we could have gotten arrested for the other stuff. But we wound up taking LSD, and here's the day that my life changed. My life has changed a couple of times, but this was the seismic shift. So drop acid, this guy named Dr. Timothy Leary comes in, they tell him the story, and he's there, and all I remember him saying, oh, don't worry, it'll hit you in about an hour or hit you in about 40, something like that. And I didn't know what he meant by it. It would hit us. Weird talk to us, but we were cool, having a good time. Anyway, the reason why the Doors were so important, because they had a cathode ray television, and they had taken the tube out, and they just kept the enclosure. And they put Christmas lights in with angel hair, and it was just flashing on and off, going, this is the end. Beautiful friend.
Oh, no.
This is the end.
It's like a bad trip.
It was hysterical, though. We were laughing. We were having so much fun. I mean, with all the sex going on around us, it wasn't a bad trip at all. This was amazing. And finally, the LSD kicked in, and we just stared at this thing. So we must have listened to that song. Had to be 10 hours. And we loved it.
Crazy.
We loved it. And then
crazy.
But I do remember getting home about a day and a half later. My poor grandmother was freaking out. She's crying, explaining to the cops, I think he's been kidnapped or murdered. And all of a sudden, I come walking up with my skates in my hand, totally cool. I think I wound up skating home. And she's freaking out, and the cops are like, wah. And of course, that sort of was the end of that relationship. My grandmother was ready to send me home back to New York with my mom. And the unfortunate thing was my grandmother actually had cancer, and she had probably been housing it for some time, but she was just so stubborn and so strong and a real workhorse, and she owned her own business. And if she didn't go to work, things just didn't work out right. So a couple of days after that incident, she went for a checkup. And they put her in the hospital, and they said that she had stage 4 cervical cancer, and she never came home. She died in the hospital. Okay, so at that point, I had to come back to New York to live with my mom. But before I left, my grandfather had a guitar, which he never let me touch. But if he was out of the house, I'd pick up the guitar and touch it, and I'd start playing bass lines. So I remember playing do 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 when the music's over, or I couldn't play the fast riff. I couldn't play do 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 do. I could play boom. You know that I could be on do 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 do. And then there was another TV show at the time that was really popular called The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And the bass line would go. Bum 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 bum. And then it was like Peter Gunn. Bum 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 bum. You know, I was already a good music reader and a music student, so I knew I could put these motifs together and make discernible melodies, but still couldn't quite figure out the guitar thing because I had never been exposed to the guitar because it's not part of the symphony orchestra.
So your musical career, as we all know it now, came off the back of a Doors album.
Yeah, totally.
That's incredible.
Totally. 100%.
I'm going to go and listen to that tonight.
Check that album out. It's amazing. You'll be blown away. But now remember, though, so I had really 3 different musical environments. The music at school, all classical. We played everything from, you know, Mozart to Prokofiev, Beethoven, everything. That's all we played. And it's interesting that the music that we listened to, because this is the music that the girls were listening to in the hood, was all R&B. So that's what I listened to with them. Now the music that I listened to at home was all bebop and modern jazz. So I had 3 distinctive musical personalities, and I was well-versed in all of them. In other words, we could talk about Wagner's use of the half diminished chord just as well as I could sing the lyrics to Don't Mess With Bill. So I was like, you know, whichever group I was with, I was completely comfortable.
Is it correct you played on Sesame Street as well?
Oh, yeah. That was my first professional job. I got the job because I was such a good music reader, because guitarists are notoriously bad music readers. Wow. It's like, you know, I remember my first session with the famous guys, and I only got the gig because Luther Vandross was my boss. Luther Vandross was also on Sesame Street. And Luther kept telling all his friends, wow, this guy, Niall, man, he can really play guitar, and you should see how fast he can read, and he's really good. So now Luther was doing his album. He was signed to Atlantic Records, and he was doing his second album. Now, I don't know if you know anything about Luther's compositions, but when David Bowie formed the Young Americans, he actually just took one of Luther's songs, which was called, on Luther's album, it's called Funky Music. On David Bowie's album, it's called Fascination, but it's the exact same song. So it's exactly the same song. So I used to play Funky Music with Luther all the time. And now he's doing his second album, and he wants me to be on the album. Typically, the way R&B albums were made in those days, and probably most albums, is that you would have section leaders. So a person would do the vocals, another person would do the horns, somebody would do the strings. and then somebody else would hire the rhythm section. Now, every now and then you would get an arranger who did all of that, or a producer who did all of that. In the case of this Luther album that I played on, which was my first record with the big guys,
the grown-ups.
Yeah, right. With the everybody in the room had a name that I knew, right? It was like, wow. I had never met any of them, but I knew everyone's name. So I'm in the room. As a matter of fact, Steve Ferroni from Average White Band was the drummer on the gig.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that.
So Steve Ferroni, first time I met him. So he was the drummer. So Jeff Mironoff was one guitar player. Cornell Dupree. Cornell Dupree, Jeff Mironoff, and Nile Rodgers. There was David Friedman on vibes. I'm trying to think who was playing bass. I'm not sure, but it was one of those really famous guys. But the whole section were famous. Richard T. on piano and all that kind of thing. So,
which studio would that have been in?
This was at Atlantic Studios.
Atlantic, okay.
Yeah, and Luther was signed to Atlantic. And so Harold Wheeler was the music director and the arranger. He did the full arrangement, the string arrangement, everything. So we sit down and we do the first run through. So we're working on the first song and we're playing. And I'm like not a smart ass. I'm really a kind, polite young kid. And we play the first tune and this is the very first run through. And I could hear who's screwing up, but of course I'm not going to say anything. You know, I'm just playing. I'm the only guy in the room that Harold Wheeler doesn't know, right? He knows everyone else because they're all famous. So right away he picks on me and he says, Youngblood, what's that bullshit you're playing there? And I said without even thinking, oh, excuse me, sir, I'm playing the bullshit you have written here on the chart. Every musician in the room was going, trying not to laugh. Because I wasn't even thinking. I certainly wasn't trying to be a smart aleck. God, I had all the respect in the world for him. I mean, he was amazing. And of course, I wanted him to call me for more sessions. And so now Luther is cracking up. Luther is laughing his head off. Luther says, well, hey, Harold, why don't we go inside the control room and let's just solo the tracks. You know, you can find out who was playing. So we go in, and I'm sitting there, and it's like I'm like a dunce in school, like with the conical hat on. You know, like, oh, no. So he plays it, and he solos my track. I'm looking at the chart. Yeah, well, you know, Mr. Wheeler, you know where the formato was? I was sort of looking at you, and maybe I cut off a little early, but I think that's the only mistake that's here. What do you hear? Then we open up a couple of the other dudes' tracks, and that's where you're hearing all the bling, 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 looking, you know, looking for the groove and the chord changes and what have you. And Luther is laughing, and he says, Harold, I just want to tell you, this guy is the best guitar reader I've ever met in my life, so yeah. I knew it wasn't his track. But Harold didn't take kindly to me. I never did another Harold Wheeler session ever. No. So it's not like he was impressed. He was just like, argh.
As well as these chats with my musical friends, we've also been meeting musicians who've benefited from Help Musicians and whose careers have been saved and supported by this wonderful charity. Whether through financial support, mental health support, training, mentoring, or enhancing skill sets. Let's now meet one of those wonderful people.
Hi, I'm Love Sega. I'm a solo artist and a songwriter and self-producing, and I'm based in South London. In terms of music that I make, I like to call it alternative pop music just because I've got lots of different influences. Starting off having a Ugandan family, music is so big in East Africa. Parents loving Motown, funk, James Brown, the like. And then growing up, felt quite lucky in London at the beginning of the wave of grime, the original Dizzy Rascal, Kano, Getz, all of that. So I say alternative pop just to reflect that and not be boxed into one type of category or another. The first thing I did was in a band, and that band, Clean Bandit, has gone on to be super massive, and like one of my proudest achievements was performing on Glastonbury's other stage in front of 45,000 people. So that's fantastic. So that goes to show the power of music. You can start off, you know, the two of us doing a song in university bedrooms, and it can go to the biggest stage and perform that song with them around the world. My proudest achievement is actually the song which I released last, which is called Our World Fight for Air. There's an issue of air pollution here in South London, and coming from the black community, and at that time with COVID coming out, we were hearing how black and Asian communities were being hit the hardest just because of where we live. It was the first time where I got a chance to create music for a reason and a campaign and a cause. So this was something where I wanted to reach out and speak to different members of my communities. Before, I was just doing normal music stuff. You write a song, you work with musicians, you go to the studio, thinking that's it. Whereas Help Musicians, Fusion Fund specifically, where it's like, look, no, you can collaborate with a dancer, a curator, work with a choreographer and director. Yeah, here's some money to go and try it out. Go and do something because it'll be good for you artistically and just interesting and foster these different connections. So that's what all musicians now need to do, because if live isn't coming back in the same way, we need to be inventive just to figure out what's the best way of using my music and my musical skill in a different area, a different sphere. The Fusion Fund, in a way, set me up to make me more confident, and it was great. Yeah. Sometimes creatively, we're all sensitive souls. You need the confidence just by one person or one organization to say, do you know what? Yeah, we believe in what you're doing. This is a good idea. But also, I got the Do It Differently Fund. It was great to get the mentoring support, because it's difficult to get mentorship in music. So people don't really give out free advice that much. So I hope more people are now aware of what Help Musicians do. They're like, okay, you want to make art? Here you go. We'll support you. And that's what it should be.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. All of those disciplines that you learned in those early days, do you engage in those disciplines when you're producing an album now?
That's why I am who I am. So when you're a kid or a novice or a journeyman and you hear certain statements, sometimes us musicians apply them in a sort of dogmatic way because we don't know what they mean. We just hear it for the first time. So I used to love the Monkees, and everybody started dissing the Monkees, or you know, are saying the Monkees aren't the real thing because other musicians play their track, songs. Yeah. They said, but the Beatles are self-contained. And all of a sudden, this concept of being self-contained meant something to me. So Chic, we were really self-contained. We didn't have George Martin to write our strings. I wrote the strings. We didn't have, you know, somebody to write the horn part. I wrote the horn. We were totally, totally self-contained. We did everything ourselves. And we thought that that's what you had to do to be a real band. We didn't know that it was perfectly all right to have an arranger. It was perfectly all right to have someone else write your strings. Like, most people can't write for strings. But we didn't know that. It was like, Bernard was like, wow, man, I'm really glad that we're in the band together, because you can do all the string charts. I was like, oh, okay.
I know from watching you at the side of the stage at Glastonbury that when you play, there's so much joy in everybody's faces, not just in the audience, but in the band. And it's like being at the church of Nile Rodgers. I felt like so emotionally attached to your songs, almost to the point I wanted to cry with joy. Is that how you feel when you're on stage?
You've described it pretty much, man. I've shed many a tear on stage because I love this music. When Bernard and I started composing together, we made a pact between each other. I came from a really bohemian political background. He came from the South, where if he were walking down the street, you know, on the sidewalk, and a white person approached him, he was obliged to walk out into the street and let that person pass and then go back on the sidewalk. So it's like, wow, are you kidding? I'm like, dude, my stepfather's white. I'm like, shit, I'd be walking out in the street all day long if I were going out. You know, I don't understand that concept. As a matter of fact, I didn't even understand that other people thought it was weird that my stepfather was white until one day he came to school because the teacher was complaining about my behavior, and all the other kids were going, oh, wow, look at that. Now his father's white. Now his father's white. I was like, oh, I guess there's something wrong with that. Okay. It actually did answer the question, though. I always wondered why, because my dad always had a ton of black friends, and his two wives were both black. His wife before my mom was black, and my mom was black. But all of his friends used to call him White Bobby, and now I got it. Because all their friends who were Bobby were black, except this one who was white.
It is a very emotional journey, your music. I know it's, you know, people go mad, they dance and freak out, so to speak, you know, and they engage in the rhythm and the sexuality of the music. But there's also a spirituality to it, and I wonder whether that comes from you being such a survivor.
And it also is the fact that our stories are all nonfiction, with mm-hmm. just fictional elements laid in to make a complete idea. But every song we've ever written, every song I've ever played that was mine, is a real thing. I mean, the idea came from a real life event that I decided to put in song form. Yeah. So many times when I do start crying on stage when I'm playing, it's not because I'm like, you know, like I have any kind of imbalance or anything like that. I mean, I actually am crying because music makes me cry. When I was a kid watching musicals, like every time they go rescue the cat in Breakfast at Tiffany's, I start crying. When Sammy Davis Jr. sings "There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York," I start crying. When me they too. Sing "There's a Place for Us," somewhere a place for us, I start crying. I can't help it. So our songs have those moments to me because I remember when I was writing it. I remember when I wrote "I Want Your Love." I dreamt "I Want Your Love," every single note.
When you're producing the incredible production you've done, like with David Bowie, for instance, do you let them just grow within the studio? Do you push them? How hard is your discipline?
Not hard at all. I don't have to push.
You don't have to?
Nah, we either it's happening or it's not. There's a demo of Let's Dance. You can find it on YouTube because Bowie's estate let me put it up because I had mm-hmm. forgotten that I did that entire album in 2 days when we were doing the demos, save for Ricochet, which we wrote in the studio. But I didn't know that. I thought that the only song I did in Switzerland was Let's Dance, because David walked into my bedroom one morning and said, "No, darling, I have this song. I really think it's a hit." I don't mean to do his accent, but he always sounded like that to me. And he played this folk song that was a nice little lick and could have been a cute little ditty. But he called it Let's Dance. I was like, whoa, David, man, I come from dance music. Even though I haven't used that word in a long time since the whole disco sucks thing, you can do anything you want to do. Don't get me to do a song that says "Let's Dance" and make nobody dance. Wow, that's no. But the thing is that, see, David was a really brilliant, complicated genius, and he loved jazz, really loved jazz. And I knew he understood the vernacular, so I asked him if I could do an arrangement, and he said, "Yeah, bingo."
Brilliant. Thank God.
The arrangement is what you hear if you listen to that demo. So I had to do this arrangement in my head somewhat, although I did have my guitar with me. But you still don't know what the groove is going to sound like. You can guess at it, but, you know, I don't play piano really, so I can only do one lick at a time and hope that they marry. And when you listen to this demo, you'll hear a person scream, because David was singing with us while we were playing it. But the person that's screaming is me, because I'm like going, "It worked!" And it worked right from the jump. We played, bim, bim, bim. Doom, doo, 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 doo. And I go, ow!
That's when God hits, right?
Right.
That's when God arrives.
Exactly.
So Help Musicians is a charity that's given out like £17 million in the last year during the pandemic to musicians who've been in the dark places and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there's enough empathy in the music industry?
Enough empathy in the industry? So that's an interesting question, because the industry to me means, it means the people who own our music as well as the people who make our music. I think that the people who make our music, the musicians, the artists themselves, are not only empathetic. I mean, you know as well as I know, if someone calls you to participate in a cause, how many times have you said no?
Absolutely.
You're right there. I mean, we, as I said, musicians are the most altruistic people. And I didn't mean just because they want to teach you a new chord or a new way of playing a scale. Just because we're wired like that. We're wired to help people. And I think it's because of our job, right? We usually play in ensembles. Like, rarely do you just walk out on stage all by yourself and say, okay, I'm going to wow this crowd, you know. like I always say, you know, Beethoven can write the Ninth Symphony, but he can't play it. He needs a symphony orchestra to play it.
That's a great quote.
So that's what we do. We need others to make our music a reality.
Absolutely. But what I suppose I mean is people, you know, companies like Spotify, you know, could be more helpful to the songwriters on the ground who are not making enough. And
in that case, I say, right, that the industry, the business part of the industry is not nearly as altruistic and as giving as the people who make the music. To be a little bit fair, we make music and make our deals, and that's our money coming back to us. We don't have stockholders that we have to pay, usually, unless you're Maroon 5, I guess. And I'm just saying, I don't know, Maroon 5 may have changed their
setup
by now, because they've been so famous for a while. But you typically don't have investors and stockholders that you're subordinate to. They will support you monetarily, but let you run with the artistic ideas. It's because they believe in you. I mean, that's how I got started. Some guys lent us a certain amount of money. We made an album, and we gave them their share.
I think it's great that there's companies like Hypnosis, for instance, who are coming along and managing songs for the first time instead of just publishers running away with nothing. You know?
Right.
It's kind of like there is a future.
That's what we do. Yeah, it's funny. Every morning I wake up and I look at the amount of licensing that I do just for my own songs. And then I think that because now Hypnosis has bought my partner, Bernard Edwards, his catalog, they're actually working on behalf of me too, even though I'm part of Hypnosis, but they don't have my portion of my catalog yet. So it's amazing to wake up every morning and see Hypnosis managing my titles. And it's always really cool because Merck is my manager. So he actually even called me and say, what do you think about this, mate? Every other word is mate. What do you think about this, mate? Hey, mate, what are we going to do? Mate. I'm like going, all right, we're not playing chess, brother. I've never had that kind of relationship before. I've actually gone through my entire career, believe it or not, without a manager. Couple of times that I've had managers, they've never lasted longer than a few months. So all that huge success that Bernard and I had, we never had managers. We did everything ourselves because we knew what we wanted. We didn't need somebody else to help us do that, because to us, what was managing? We make records every day. Well, who's going to manage that? Merck never comes in and says, you don't know how that should be a B flat minus seven there instead of, you know, I mean, where are you coming from, man? That, he doesn't do that. So because our lives, our early lives were all about making music, making records, and the occasional tour and gig, okay, what are you going to do? Come in and tell me, I'm making records today. I know I'm making records today. That's what I do. Every record that I've made most of my life has all been because of a chance meeting with someone. I go out to a club and run into Duran Duran, poof. Run into Madonna, run into Bowie, run into Hall & Oates, run into B-52s. That's my whole life has been that.
I know from watching you on Instagram and stuff, you say this mantra, less terror, more firmer, about flying. And I have a flying phobia, so when I read that, it gives me inspiration. But you've gone through so many health issues in the last few years. I wonder whether this fear of flying has kind of been tipped into a tip, considering.
Yeah, it's funny that flying is like the most comfortable place in the world to me now.
Really?
Tonight, when I finish with you, I'm going to be filming all day.
Okay.
And at 5:30 in the morning, I'm moving to Miami tomorrow. I can't believe it. I've lived in New York and Connecticut all my life, New York, Connecticut, and California. And I'm moving to Miami tomorrow morning. And it's like the scene down there musically has got me so excited. It feels like the three places that I could really just immerse myself in music all day long would be Nashville, Miami, and London. And that's
Abbey Road.
Yeah, and that's sort of where I'm going to be working and doing all my recording, you know.
So you're going to be doing a lot of flying then?
Oh, yeah. Tons and tons. You know, I have 1,000,000 miles on 3 different carriers. So that's how much flying I do. It's honestly the most relaxing place in the world to me. It's the only place that I'm guaranteed sleep because I'm not a good sleeper.
No, I remember reading that too. Niall, I have to thank you so much for your time. I know you've got filming to do and then you'll move into Florida, and I wish you all the best with that.
Thank you, brother.
God bless you, Niall Rogers.
Peace, my man. Take care. Great to see you, man.
Great to see you. I'm having to pinch myself because I can't believe that I've just been in conversation with Niall Rogers. His stories just go on forever. It's absolutely amazing, his life. It really is. It's an inspiration. He's such a generous fella. He's always smiling, and he's always full of the joys of life, which is just incredible. The only thing I think I've got in common with Niall, apart from his love of music, of course, is a fear of flying. So, less terror, more firmer. Niall Rogers, thank you so much. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.